We love a Christmas miracle. We would love all of our loved ones to come back and be with us for Christmas.
Families of the American-Israeli hostages held in Gaza meet with the president at the White House as they plea for negotiations to broker the successful release of their loved ones.
While I deplore all hateful speech, anti-Semitic speech remains in America protected.
Freedom of speech or anti-Semitism? Concerns about what is being taught and embraced on college campuses. Expert analysis.
Our Lady of Guadalupe, as we all know, is our Blessed Mother, and she plays a very important role in my life because I go to her to look for her intercession whenever I am going through many difficulties in my spiritual life.
Some 500 years after the apparition at Guadalupe, Catholics continue to call on her for help. A look at one annual pilgrimage for the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
They work on their own human formation, their prayer life, and their life of charity.
Preparing young men for the priesthood. How seminarians are drawing closer to Christ through missionary work with the poor in Mexico. Our Savior in the stable. The saint behind the iconic image of the Holy Family. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
And if one sizable missile targets each of these churches, it means that's the end of Christianity in Gaza. And Gaza has been always historically Christian in the sense that it's Christian since 2,000 years ago.
The conflict between Israel and Hamas has not just been devastating for the Israeli and Palestinian communities, it could also mean the end of Christian life in Gaza. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The war has reached day 70. Following the brutal Hamas terrorist attack on Israel on October 7th. The United States has been Israel's biggest ally and global supporter. But this week, some cracks started to emerge in the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
I want them to be focused on how to save civilian lives, not stop going after Hamas, but be more careful.
President Joe Biden has warned what he called indiscriminate bombing could erode international support and has reportedly urged Israel to be more targeted in its attacks. But this week, Israeli leaders repeated their determination to continue their military assault on Gaza, even as U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan went to Tel Aviv to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and discuss a timetable for winding down major combat in Gaza. Israeli's defense minister told Sullivan he predicts a drawn-out war, though his country faces international isolation over the devastation and increasing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. That growing isolation was evident this week at the United Nations when the General Assembly overwhelmingly voted to demand a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza.
As I said before, even war has rules. It is incumbent upon us, as the United Nations, to bring an immediate end to the suffering of innocent civilians.
There are no war crimes more heinous than the atrocities Hamas committed. And those that support this resolution are giving the terrorists a free pass. A ceasefire means one thing and one thing only, ensuring the survival of Hamas.
The Israeli ambassador went viral on social media when he gave out the personal cell phone number of the Hamas leader, as he told his UN colleagues if they wanted to end the fighting, they should call him, tell him to lay down his weapons and return the hostages. But the measure passed by a lopsided vote of 153 in favor, 10 against, and 23 abstentions. Just last week, the U.S. vetoed a resolution in the Security Council demanding a ceasefire. But Arab and Islamic nations called an emergency session of the entire General Assembly to make the same demand. Unlike Security Council resolutions, General Assembly resolutions are not legally binding, but do impact public perceptions. On Wednesday at the White House, the focus was on the remaining U.S. hostages being held in Gaza, most of them dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. President Biden held his first in-person meeting with their families.
The U.S. administration is completely committed to getting the hostages out, the eight Americans who remain there and the other nearly 130. We have no doubt about that. And today's meeting with President Biden and Secretary Blinken only reinforced that.
The family members told reporters the hour-long meeting was terrific, and they said Mr. Biden told them he was doing everything in his power to bring their loved ones home. In this war, a very small sliver of the population is Christian on both sides, in Israel and in Gaza. With fewer than 1,000 Christians in a population of roughly 1.8 million, the Christian population in Palestine's Gaza Strip is less than half of what it was 10 years ago. And that shrinking group is feeling the effects of the conflict as much as their Jewish and Muslim neighbors. Reporter Mark Iron spoke to a Christian Gazan who is studying in Washington. He shared his thoughts about the war and his family back home.
Concerned for his family, he makes a call. But it can't be connected.
That happens every day.
That happens every day.
Cell service has become unreliable as war between Israel and Hamas rages on. Halil Sayer, a Palestinian living in Washington, D.C., might go weeks without hearing directly from his family in Gaza.
So you're living days at a time wondering just if your family's alive or not.
Absolutely.
I mean, how do you deal with that?
It's hard. It's very difficult for someone to look at your elderly mother and father there, your youngest brother and sister, my nephews, just the newborn nephew, Khadr, and thinking that I can do nothing to stop their pain.
Halil fears for his family's safety. Although Israel has said it is focused on destroying Hamas, innocent Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, the death toll in Gaza has reached more than 18,000 people. According to an Israeli estimate, about 7,000 of those killed have been armed Hamas operatives. But among those caught in the crosshairs, Palestinian Christians, including Halil's family members who are huddled together with hundreds of other Christians on the grounds of Holy Family Catholic Church in Gaza. This video from last month shows reaction inside the church following a nearby missile strike. And more reports indicate the church took on damage over the weekend after the Palestinians taking shelter were killed. Halil is concerned about their access to food, medicine, and security, especially after a historic Greek Orthodox Christian church compound was hit in an Israeli airstrike in October, resulting in the deaths of 18 people. Some were Halil's relatives.
Three kids of my relative and close friend Ramiz were killed.
Halil believes that Christians in Gaza, who are already in the minority, making up much less than 1% of the population, totaling less than 1,000 people in all, have a great struggle ahead as violence continues.
With what's happening right now, do you feel that the Christian identity in that region could be lost if this continues?
I think so, unfortunately. When this war happened, one thing I heard from all the Christians that were leaving, we want to leave, we don't want to stay there. There is no reason for us to lose our lives.
And for those who try to return to their homes in Gaza, he says there might not be much to come back to.
Gaza is not a place that can be re-inhabited soon. The infrastructure is completely destroyed.
Christian roots run deep in the Middle East. But among many Israelis and Palestinians, the Jewish and Muslim faith traditions play a major role in everyday life in a conflicted region that historically cannot achieve peace.
You have these two different world religions represented in Judaism and Islam. What perspective, I guess, can you bring to the conflict as a Christian?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I sometimes find myself thinking, well, Christians can't have any impact as Christians, given that we're less than 1% right now, right? But one thing that always our priest used to say is that we are the salt of the earth, right? And the salt tend to be very little, but yet it's supposed to bring certain taste to it. And that's, I think, our role. Our role is to be salt of the earth. That I do believe that Christians have role in peacemaking and role in bridging the gap between the two sides.
Throughout all this, are you relying on your Christian faith?
But to be honest with you, Mark, it's really difficult. It's difficult in the sense that one feels like he's one of the Psalms writers, when you're literally saying to God, where are you from all this pain? Where are you from children being killed, women, where are you from my family being starved and others? In the Christian story, one of the most important elements is that the same way I feel, God feels this pain. And I think there's something comforting about that.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
To further explore the impact on the Christian community in the region, we're joined by Naveen Elias, who is speaking to us from her home in northern Israel near the Lebanon border. Naveen is the operations director at the Israeli Christian Aramaic Association and an advocacy fellow at the Philos Project. Naveen, welcome to our show and thank you for making time for us. You work to create collaboration and relationships between different communities in Israel. What has that looked like since the war broke out?
So, hello, everyone. I will explain for you a little bit about ICAA and our activity here. ICAA is Israeli Christian Aramaic NGO. It's educational Aramaic center founded by Christian Major Reserve Shadi Khalul. Its mission is to assist native Christian Israeli minority better integrate within Israeli society while preserving their Aramaic language and heritage. We at our Aramaic Center provide knowledge about Middle Eastern Christian status and needs in Lebanon to all visitors and interest groups. We at ICA organized a donation from supporters in Europe and USA from Philos Passages to help our IDF soldiers with clothing and food in our Upper Galilee region who are protecting us during this wartime. It is important they know that we also, as Christian Aramaic minority, appreciate their sacrifice. This is important. It strengthens their moral. Also, we organized a Christian delegation to visit the hostages square to stand in solidarity with our Jewish brothers and sisters, asking the world as one united people to help with immediate release of our Israeli hostages from Hamas ISIS terrorists. Another activity we do as a part of our leadership pre-military educational leadership academy is to light Hanukkah candle daily devoted for the IDF matres and hostages. Both Christian and Jewish youth on this unique program participate together to expand light from the Sea of Galilee where the program operates.
You're a Christian though, right, Naveen? To what community do you belong to and how many of you are there? You're Aramaic, right?
Yeah. We are native Christian community, first followers of Jesus Christ in the land of Israel. We belong to the Syriac Aramaic Maronite Church of Antioch. It is a community that has Syriac Aramaic Phoenician ethnic background, preserving ancient Christianity with Aramaic Syriac prayers and language. In 2014, Israel responded positively to our ICAA NGO request and recognized our 2% around 150,000 Christian population as Aramaic native people of the land. Since then, we are helping all of them to be registered under their Aramaic national identity as Israeli citizens. By the way, in Arab countries, our Christian brothers are not recognized as such until today and feel their Aramaic identity and language are being annihilated. At least here in Israel, after this ICAA American organization recognition achievement, We provided hope for survival and long-lasting existence of our people. We have much more to do and obstacles to overcome. We are sure together with our supporters, a generosity, we will succeed.
Now, I know that you mentioned that you're helping the IDF soldiers, so the Israeli military, and that you're involved in them. You have members who are of your community that are there. How did this attack on October 7th, how did that affect you personally?
So October 7th, Hamas ISIS terrorists attacked on southern Israel civilians, shocked me. It is a flashback to our Christian and Maronite community suffered during the civil war in Lebanon. Why? Because this experience made us aware of jihadist brutality. So I was not surprised, but I was shocked they succeeded to infiltrate the IDF front lines before reaching the civilians. Today, I live in fear from another attack by Hezbollah in the north, and as a mother of three children, and especially for my son Elias, who is serving in IDF, to defend our home and country.
Now, Naveen, you just mentioned your son, a Christian who's been fighting with the IDF and came home for a visit recently. What's it like knowing that he's there? And was this visit a surprise?
Yeah, it was a surprise. He just was serving in the south, and it was a very difficult situation there. And he cannot be with the phone. He cannot tell us where is he now, and cannot share anything because it's like very dangerous and it's secret. And after 1 month, he just like the last minute, the captain there, he say that you can be off for 24 hours, and he make for us surprise, and he came here. And after like few days that we didn't hear anything about him. So it was really surprised. But in the same day, I also in reserve and I should go for a very important meeting. So it was like he came and after 1 hour, I need to go to a reserve. But a few minutes with Elias after 1 month, it was really like we was very excited and happy. We cannot explain for you. And also he came and he like we are already moved for my new home. And it was really surprise for him and for us.
For him to see everything ready for Christmas, too, I'm sure. What is your prayer?
No, he until now didn't see the Christmas tree.
Oh, no, no Christmas tree. Okay, not yet. That'll be for the next visit, God willing. What is your prayer, Naveen, then, for this war? You're personally involved. Your family is a part of it. What is your prayer?
So I pray like all our ICA NGO members for God to help my state, Israeli, eliminating this create and bring peace with the prosperity to our state together with its neighboring countries. In the personal level, I pray for my son, family, and Aramaic Christian people protecting too. And if you have time, also I can pray for you the Lord's Prayer in Jesus' language.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Abon it beshmayo nit kadash ishmo titi malkuto nihwi sibiano aikanut beshmayo baro hablan lahmut sunkunan yawmono واشبوق لنحوين وحطوهاي أي كانوا دافحنان شبقني الحيوبي ولو تعلان النسيانا إنو فصول من بيشان ميتول دي لخي ملكوت حينا تشبحت العالم علم آمين.
Amen. Thank you so much. Well, we're praying with you for peace and for your safety. Thank you so much, Naveen.
Thank you.
A White House request to Congress for emergency war funding for both Israel and Ukraine remains in limbo. This week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Washington to meet with the president and lawmakers on Capitol Hill to try to persuade them to pass the supplemental $110 billion funding bill. Congressional Republicans have insisted that a deal on U.S.-Mexico border security issues be part of the package. In meetings with lawmakers, President Zelensky told them the future of his country is at stake and that Ukrainian forces have fought fiercely to push back the Russian invasion.
And even though we've been emphasizing the border, I want to remind everybody of the importance of Ukraine. We heard from the president today. He is inspirational. They have fought one of our biggest adversaries for almost 2 years now.
This is a moment we must meet. If Ukraine falls, it will be a historic, colossal tragedy. Historians will look back on this, not 2 weeks from now, but years from now, and say this was one of the turning points where Western civilization took a dramatic turn downward.
At a joint press conference at the White House with Zelensky, President Biden warned that failure by the United States to provide Ukraine further aid would only embolden Vladimir Putin and other aggressors on the world stage. Still to come, the U.S. Supreme Court will weigh in on the abortion debate again, the first time since the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
Is that speech according to the code of conduct or not?
We embrace a commitment to free expression.
But first, fallout continues across university campuses after contentious congressional testimony on Capitol Hill. Plus, federal funding for Planned Parenthood, the shocking data revealed in a recently released report.
That it is against the code of conduct at Harvard?
We embrace a commitment to free expression, even of views that are objectionable, offensive, hateful.
Does that speech not cross that barrier? Does that speech not call for the genocide of Jews and the elimination of Israel?
The Harvard Governing Board said this week President Claudine Gay will continue as leader of the prestigious Ivy League school after last week's contentious congressional hearing about anti-Semitic violence on campus. MIT's Sally Kornbluth and the University of Pennsylvania's Liz McGill also testified last week. During that hearing, none of the school leaders explicitly said that calling for the genocide of Jews would necessarily violate their university's code of conduct. McGill has since resigned after criticism she did not go far enough to condemn threats against Jewish students on her campus.
A resolution is agreed to.
On Wednesday, the House passed a bipartisan resolution calling for Harvard and MIT's presidents to also resign. The resolution condemned their testimonies as well as anti-Semitism on college campuses nationwide. The three leaders were invited to testify as the public faces of universities embroiled in protests in the wake of the Israel-Hamas war. The surge in anti-Semitism and reports of Islamophobia have sparked investigations by the U.S. Education Department. On Tuesday, investigations into Stanford, UCLA, and Rutgers were announced among a growing list of colleges facing a federal discrimination probe. It comes after alleged incidents of discrimination against students on campus for their race, color, or national origin. The probes were launched under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. After investigating, the department will make recommendations to the schools, which risk losing federal funding if they don't comply. So what is freedom of speech? Where is the line between a threat, an opinion, or a call to violence? Our country prides itself on our civil liberties, but like with all laws, applying them is complicated. John Tomasi is the president of the Heterodox Academy, a nonprofit organization that supports free speech and viewpoint diversity on college campuses. He joins us now to weigh in on this topic. Welcome, John. It's good to have you here. Tell us a little about Heterodox Academy. Why was it started? What trends were you seeing in institutions of higher education that were worrisome?
Hi, I'm the president of Heterodox Academy. HXA was started by John Haidt in 2015 as a response to some of our concerns about the lack of diversity within higher education. We're a membership organization of 6,000 professors all around the country who are committed to open inquiry, viewpoint diversity, and constructive disagreement. We're professors who love our universities, who are acutely aware that they've gone astray in really important ways, and we're trying to make them better from the inside.
Well, we've all seen the news. University presidents are facing calls for resignation over anti-Semitism on their campus. Let's just hear some more of those testimonies before we dive in. Take a listen.
The free exchange of ideas is the foundation upon which Harvard is built, and safety and well-being are the prerequisites for engagement in our community.
There is a difference between what we can say to each other, that is what we have a right to say, and what we should say as members of one community. Yet as president of MIT, in addition to my duties to keep the campus safe, I must at the same time ensure that we protect speech and viewpoint diversity for everyone.
I know that we need both safety and free expression for universities and ultimately democracy to thrive. In these times, these competing principles can be difficult to balance, but I am determined to get it right.
This free exchange of ideas is vital for our nation to flourish, but students don't feel safe since the outbreak of the war. Where is the line we draw here? How does your membership feel about all of this, all of the debate around speech here?
I think most of our members were shocked by the presidential testimony. There was a lack of leadership, a lack of vision, a lack of candor, frankly, about what universities have been doing. To hear Claudine Gay say that Harvard is committed to free exchange of ideas is a wonderful and a very welcome statement. But the reality is that Harvard and other universities have not been defending free speech. They've shown an extreme insensitivity to free speech until very recently. And the hypocrisy that's been on display has shocked all of us.
Now, John, the members of your organization, they have joined you because they felt like they couldn't express themselves on campus. Is there a move here to support these students who feel like they have nowhere else to go?
That's right. HXA is a nonpartisan organization. We're committed to these deep values of open inquiry. We believe the universities need to be called to account for the hypocrisy, for the double standards they've been employing. We've seen an era of hypersensitivity to speech. At Harvard, for example, a professor was hounded out because she simply said that biologically there are two sexes. At MIT, a speaker was disinvited because he thought that merit was an important part of admissions. So these are just regular speech statements that these universities have not defended in the past couple of years. And to hear them now say that calls for genocide should be allowed, or at least to be ambivalent about that, is pretty shocking to all of us.
Now, John, Bishop Barron, a prominent Catholic priest, wrote about the congressional testimonies a few days ago. He says that the idea of intrinsically evil acts has disappeared. That means an act by its nature that is disordered and could never be justified. He writes, "When we lose a sensitivity to the intrinsically evil, we fall automatically into a moral relativism, whereby even the most egregiously wicked act can be justified or explained away." What are your thoughts on this and how it affects speech on university campuses? Is this the lens that professors and leadership should be using to help some of these students understand the Israel and Hamas war?
I think this concern about the lack of objective truth and the concern for objectivity is an important one. It's not the job of universities, though, to speak with one voice about those kinds of controversial issues. What's been really upsetting to us and worrying to us is that universities have been speaking with one voice about relativism, about the lack of standards, believing that, in fact, there's no such thing as truth except truths that are previously given. What we've seen on college campuses is a simple division based on identity between oppressors and oppressed. And just being known, which being assigned to one slot into one category or the other, is sufficient to close down debate. We're in favor of open conversations, including important ones about the deep questions of life, the meaning of life, and we're open to a variety of answers. What's objectionable is this pattern we've been seeing of only one sort of answer being allowed.
So then what do these policies look like? Your organization takes a position on fostering free speech, but how can that free speech be fostered and these students at the same time be kept safe?
There has to be a principled commitment enforced in an even-handed way to prevent true threats, to prevent harassment, to prevent incitements to violence. Those are clearly objectionable violations of any campus speech code. And the president should have made that very clear at that meeting. On the other hand, we need to make space for open conversations about some of these issues. We have to have a special environment at universities that allows for an unusually wide range of points of view being expressed, precisely so we can see what's out there, so we can discuss them and work on them together.
Now, John, really quick, what is your hope from these congressional probes and from everything that we're seeing with these university leaders? What does your membership hope will happen?
I think the status quo has been shattered. And I think that now the public gaze is firmly on universities. We're having a glimpse inside what's been happening in universities for years. At HXA, we've been tracking the rise of some of these deeply illiberal, deeply intolerant viewpoints. And now we're seeing the university's presence being called to account to be more consistent in their defense of free speech. I was delighted to hear these presidents talk about their commitment to free speech, but it's a newfound commitment. And it seems to be applying only in the cases where Jews are being attacked. We'd love to see them be committed to free speech in deep and principled ways. And we're willing to support any president who wants to do that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, John. We look forward to seeing how this develops.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Still to come, Pope Francis celebrates two special personal anniversaries.
It just gives me strength on a daily basis. It helps me move forward, even in the struggling, the challenging times. Knowing that our mother is always there keeps me going.
Up next, a special celebration for Our Lady of Guadalupe, the annual event honoring the patroness of the Americas. And ahead, a diocese that serves more than 1 million faithful files for bankruptcy. Stay with us.
It's the image of the first disciple, of the mother of all believers.
Pope Francis's homily on the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe earlier this week focused on the miraculous image of Our Blessed Mother preserved on the tilma, or cloak. The Holy Father says the image, which has become a cultural and spiritual symbol for Latin America, cannot be used to support any ideology, but only a message of love. Our Lady of Guadalupe is celebrated all over the world in many ways. The Archdiocese of Washington held a walk with Mary on the feast of St. Juan Diego. He was the visionary who saw Our Blessed Mother in Guadalupe and received the tilma from her. A gift to the Archdiocese helps us better understand the beautiful treasure of the tilma. Rizal Reyes explains in this Catholic Life report.
She represents Latin Americans. And being a part of El Salvador, knowing how I know a lot of Salvadorians that pray to her and love her.
Our Lady of Guadalupe, patron of the Americas.
In Latin America, Our Lady of Guadalupe devotion is huge in every country.
Declared Queen of Mexico, she is one of the most popular religious devotions. Our Lady of Guadalupe appeared on the hill of Tepeyac in Mexico in 1531. She introduced herself as the Mother of God to an indigenous peasant named Juan Diego and asked him to build her a shrine in that same spot she appeared. She wanted this as a symbol of her love and compassion with all those who believe.
She wanted that message to be sent to the bishop. The bishop didn't believe him. Until she appeared again to San Juan Diego.
He brings roses and appears to the bishop again, and the image of Our Lady appears in his tilma. How powerful.
That image of her appearance on Juan Diego's cactus fiber cloak, or tilma, served as a consolation to the oppressed natives of Mexico. Even now, her image serves as a message of hope to the faithful, like Joanna Cotto and Edwin Mendez. Every year, both of them take part in the Archdiocese of Washington's Walk with Mary event, which celebrates Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Since I was 8 years old, I've been coming to processions. And so when I came to this country, I was looking for the same, you know, this faith in action. I wanted to see this representation of the faith. And I found it to be very important when I found out about the procession of the Walk with Mary.
Mendez grew up in El Salvador, but being involved with his parish, St. Michael the Archangel in Silver Spring, feels like home for him. Every year, he coordinates transportation of parishioners from church to the Walk with Mary event. He explains why this role is very meaningful to him.
To serve, you know, as a bridge to the people to come and, you know, pray all together, even though they belong to different cultures, but they all come together in this one day to pray.
For Cotto, she loves seeing the younger generation being proud of their heritage and loving their faith.
It's always been like an every year thing ever since that I would participate, helping with the flags, walking the procession, helping with the banner, especially participating with the ministry Tira La Red, which is a charismatic renewal ministry. We work with young adults and with teens.
The highlight of the event is a presentation of the special tilma.
I can't tell you how exciting it is and how emotional it can get. You see people tearing of joy and feeling her presence on that day.
Claudia Bartolini works for the Archdiocese of Washington's Office of Cultural Diversity and Outreach. According to her, this special tilma was gifted to the Archdiocese by nuns of the Convent of the Perpetual Adorers of the Blessed Sacrament from Michoacán, Mexico. Although the actual tilma is in Mexico City, Bartolini said this invaluable gift provides an opportunity to engage parishioners in learning about the significance of the image and its historical roots.
Every single piece of the tilma has a mystery, and that's what makes it special. The tilma appeared, came about in 1531, and the tilma is still in good condition now. You know, the material of the tilma is maguey. Maguey will not last more than 20 years. And it's still in mint shape.
The Catholic News Agency's article titled Fact or Fiction, 9 Popular Myths About Our Lady of Guadalupe, also lists other mysteries about the tilma. For instance, when the flowers and stars in the image of the Virgin Mary are viewed as musical notes, there's a beautiful melody. The article also points out the miraculous nature of the image, which looks as if the image was imprinted on the tilma.
They can't explain the material of the colors. It's not, you know, it's not a vegetable, it's not animal. They don't even know where it comes from.
Bartolini says after the Walk with Mary event, parishes can host the archdiocesan tilma for up to 2 weeks. She explains the remarkable effect the tilma has had on her.
No matter how you're feeling, when you reach out to her, she's always there to help you and to give you comfort and to give you hope that things always get better. Us as mothers evangelize our kids. We bring down the gospel. We share the gospel with them. So is our Blessed Mother.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Parishes in the Archdiocese of Washington can now host the special tilma recreation for up to 2 weeks. You can email Claudia Bartolini at the email address on your screen to find out how to host the tilma at your parish. The Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City is the most visited Marian sanctuary in the world, even exceeding the number of pilgrims to Vatican City. We'll have more on this year's pilgrimage and its impact on seminarians coming up. The week's top headlines are first in our Week in Review. Another abortion case to be decided by Supreme Court justices tops the Week in Review. The case concerns the drug mifepristone, which is used in more than half of the abortions in America. The scope of the Food and Drug Administration's authority is at the center of the dispute. The FDA ruled mifepristone safe and effective more than two decades ago. But challengers argue the agency did not do enough to study the safety implications of the drug. The justices are considering whether to restrict the abortion drug nationwide. For now, mifepristone is available as the legal battle plays out. The new case could be decided by July 2024. A congressional report released this week revealed that abortion advocacy organizations received nearly $2 billion in federal funds between 2019 and 2021. The Government Accountability Office report indicates that a vast majority, some $1.78 billion, went directly to Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Most of the funding was dispersed through the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, and the U.S. Agency for International Development. Under the Hyde-Helms amendments, federal funds were not used to pay for abortions directly, but the Hyde-Helms amendments do not limit funding for abortion providers. Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, who along with dozens of other congressional members filed a request for the data, called the findings appalling. An unprecedented call to ditch fossil fuels. Government leaders representing nearly 200 countries made the agreement at the 28th annual United Nations climate meeting known as COP28. Many warned the deal still had significant shortcomings, as it didn't call for an outright phasing out of oil, gas, and coal. The agreement calls on countries to contribute to global efforts to reduce carbon pollution in ways they see fit and could allow some countries to take minimal action.
There were many other things that we could have liked to see in this text, but we sincerely think that it is a very relevant step forward.
If it wasn't for your collective effort, we would not have been able to achieve this historic achievement.
The president of COP28, Sultan Ahmed Ali Jaber, who you just heard there, is also the chief executive of the United Arab Emirates state-owned oil companies. The UAE is one of the world's top oil-producing nations. Al Jaber raised concerns after he made remarks that he plans to increase the production of crude oil and natural gas. Religious sisters are suing the gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson, accusing the company of using illegal marketing tactics that they say facilitate a growing stream of killings. Four congregations listed on your screen are also part of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which has filed similar lawsuits in the past. The congregations also are Smith & Wesson stockholders. The Wall Street Journal reports they own 1,000 shares. The sisters say their goal is to stop the gun company from manufacturing and selling any more AR-15 rifles. The CEO of the gun company told our sister news organization, the Catholic News Agency, that Smith & Wesson is proud to empower law-abiding American citizens with the ability to defend themselves and their families from harm. The deadly stabbing of a parish priest has rocked the small community of Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. Reverend Stephen Gutzel was attacked in the rectory in what police called a break-in early Sunday morning. The 65-year-old was rushed to the hospital but passed away. Police arrested a 43-year-old who was still inside the rectory minutes after Father Gutzel dialed 911. No other details in this case have been released. The Diocese of Sacramento, California, has filed for bankruptcy amid more than 250 clergy abuse lawsuits. In Bishop Jaime Soto's announcement last weekend, he said, "Pray for the healing of victim survivors. The pain inflicted on them lasts a lifetime, and so our atonement must be a lifetime commitment." Soto also said parishes and schools will continue their operations uninterrupted. The diocese serves more than 1 million faithful across 102 parishes. The historic trial of one of the former highest-ranking members of the Vatican, Cardinal Giovanni Angelo Becciu, is expected to come to a close this weekend. Becciu is accused of fraud, embezzlement, and abuse of office, largely over his involvement in a botched investment in London real estate that used church funds. Becciu's lawyer says the cardinal never stepped outside of accordance with his office. The defense has asked for Becciu and the nine other defendants to pay fines and serve prison sentences of 7 years if found guilty. Becciu is the first cardinal to be criminally charged in the Vatican. We expect a verdict on Saturday.
a beautiful anniversary for Pope Francis this week. 54 years ago, on December 13th, he was ordained a priest. Jorge Mario Bergoglio took his holy orders by the Archbishop of Córdoba, Argentina, on the third Sunday of Advent, known as Gaudete or Joy Sunday. Bergoglio rose to become Archbishop of Buenos Aires in 1997, a cardinal in 2001, and elected Pope in 2013. And we want to wish Pope Francis a very happy birthday as well. The Holy Father will turn 87 on December 17th. We pray for his health, his leadership, and for his intentions. And returning now to Our Lady of Guadalupe, Mexico City celebrations for the feast day drew millions of people this week. It's one of the largest gatherings in all of humanity, and it happens every year. Several seminarians from the U.S. traveled there this year, and Alan Holdren shares their pilgrimage.
At the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City, on her December the 12th feast, millions of people come to show their devotion to the patroness of the Americas. This year, among the exotic pilgrims, there's also a group of American seminarians. The visit to the Guadalupe Shrine is just part of the experience for them this week. They've been out on the streets of Mexico City on mission, spending 4 days volunteering with an apostolate that has put them in contact with the poorest of the poor of Mexico City.
I want to show the seminarians from Nebraska the poor. I want them to see the poor in a new way. Today we were at an orphanage. I gave them an assignment to see Jesus, open the eyes of your heart and see Jesus in the poor.
Craig Joring, originally from the tiny town of O'Neill, Nebraska, has been doing mission work in Mexico City for 17 years. Joring's hope of the poor is changing lives, those of the poor, and those of the missionaries that join him in serving them.
So first of all, we want to help alleviate the poverty of people being alone, but we want to bring dignity, we want to bring care to people. But what we really want to do is we want to evangelize. We want to help people come to Christ. And so I worked with the poor in Mexico City on the streets and then at the dump. And the poor really helped lead us to Christ.
Spending time with families helped out of prostitution and drug dependency, assisting adults and youth in an orphanage, generally being present to those in need. Just seeing the people in every circumstance as peers and fellow children of God brings them dignity.
We're out here just visiting with all the Mexican Catholic kids and all of the poor and just, yeah, being really a family with them, showing our love and care for them.
They're probably helping me more than I'm helping them. It's a gift to see how much I have. I can value it more. I can just give thanks to God because He has given me so much.
This experience is part of a preparatory year for these young men as they discern the call to the priesthood back at St. Gregory the Great Seminary in Seward, Nebraska. Their bishop, James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln, was with Hope of the Poor in Mexico City just over a month ago, on mission himself. He wanted the young men to have a similar experience.
It's distressing. I mean, the people living on the streets, it's really kind of, you want to kind of turn away. In that experience, you see Jesus. You know, you see Christ, who was himself poor and homeless and, you know, was just, you know, vulnerable. And so that's what the purpose of bringing our seminarians to Mexico City is, to have them experience directly, you know, the poor and to minister and to love them, basically, and to be present to them. And it's part of their whole human formation that they somehow cultivate a great love for the poor.
There's the impact of the mission. And then add to that the impact of visiting the shrine for the Feast of Our Lady.
Seeing, like, people really devoted to, like, Guadalupe and Mary, and just, like, how real she is, and she's right there.
Coming here, being present, and just being in that experience, it brings so much joy and, like, amazement. It leaves me speechless.
I've spent so many hours praying with that image, but to see the real Tilma is just something I've never expected to happen in my life. And, it's kind of just shocking.
You could physically feel Mary's presence. It was incredible.
reaching out to the poor and to the Mother of God, who's just as much a gift to Mexico and the entire world today as she was after her apparitions nearly 500 years ago. Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
A Christmas tradition, the Nativity. We bring you the story of how it all started in Italy 800 years ago when we return. Stay with us.
During the Advent season, many Catholics set up a nativity in their home as they await the celebration of the birth of our Savior. But did you know the tradition was started by a saint? Colm Flynn takes us to Italy to show us the beginnings of this beautiful tribute to the Holy Family.
Thousands of people gather in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican in Rome to see the unveiling of this year's nativity scene. But what's different about this nativity scene is that, as well as having Mary and Joseph and the figures that we're all used to seeing in a crib, there's also St. Francis of Assisi and a number of Franciscan friars, and for a very special reason.
It's so beautiful. Like, I know why the people is here, like, seeing it. It's, like, amazing.
I think it's beautiful. I really like it. This is my first time here.
It reminds me, like, my young age, because I was building it also at my home with my parents. So.
Yes, I like it. Symbol of hope and Christianity.
I think about the beauty of our God who has decided to come as a man in that small little child. In Italian they say c'è qualcosa che ti colpisce. It's something that makes you think, that comes to your heart.
The nativity scene here at the Vatican this year is extra special because it's based on the very first one that was created by St. Francis of Assisi 800 years ago in the town of Greccio. It was in 1223, here in the Italian village of Greccio, that a tradition was born that would spread throughout the world. Up on this hilltop, inside a small cave, pilgrims and visitors come to pray and reflect on the birth of Christ, including Pope Francis in 2019. Father Michael Baggett is a priest who leads pilgrimages here. So, Father Michael, this is the very spot.
That's right. This is the famous Greccio cave. Very small, very simple, but powerful.
For this is the very spot of the first nativity scene ever created. Take us back 800 years. What happened here at this site?
St. Francis of Assisi was traveling and he came across this lovely town of Greccio, and it reminded him so much of the Holy Land. He was inspired in this cave to create the first manger of history. And it was not just a static piece of art, it was a living scene.
It's believed that the inspiration to do a live representation of the birth of Jesus came to St. Francis during his time in the Holy Land. Seeing the holy sites connected to Jesus' life made everything feel more real for him, and he wanted to recreate that experience for others.
He wanted everyone to experience the simplicity, the poverty, and the humility of God, who comes to us in weakness and so vulnerable, so that we are able to approach him with confidence. So we're here in a cave, and Francis didn't just bring in people, he brought in animals.
Real animals.
Yes, real animals. He's probably the first to bring in the ox and the donkey.
It was like a play, like a theater. They showed what the moment was like.
Exactly. And then, of course, this is spread throughout the church. And I was thinking to myself, just walking through St. Peter's Square, you know you're important when St. Peter's is imitating you, right? Because St. Peter's Square, as you mentioned, has a manger scene this year based on Greccio.
It's incredible to think that from those humble and simple beginnings, the nativity scene has now become such a part of the Christmas celebration all across the world. For the past 39 years, in the town of Verona in the north of Italy, an exhibition has tried to show how the nativity scene is today depicted in different ways all over the globe. Michaela is the curator of this exhibition, which has almost 200 nativity scenes from all over the world.
You can see we have got different nativity scenes from Africa. We've got a Japanese script with bamboo. And you see how different they are, because they are so simple, you know. The material they use, they have got wood, the colors, they are very delicate. And, you know, the traditions that they reflect in their masterpieces.
Isn't it so beautiful that, you know, us in our own countries, we think of the nativity scene in a certain way, but for every country around the world, they see their own people in that nativity scene.
Exactly.
And their own colors and cultures.
Exactly, their traditions, you know.
There is such a variety of nativity scenes on display, some austere and simple, while others, like the European ones, are more elaborate and detailed.
They are great. I like how they express those details. Actually, we're planning to make something similar for the Christmas. Yeah.
So many characters, it's mechanical and it's emotion.
What do you like about the nativity story?
It is a very beautiful story. There's Mary, who wants to have a child, but thinks she'll never have one. And the angel comes and tells her she'll have a child.
It's very interesting for me too. It's beautiful to see how, let's say, the nativity develops in all countries of the world, and reminds us, in short, that Jesus arrives not only in Bethlehem, but he arrives in all places and in all homes.
800 years after the first one went on display in that small town of Greccio, the nativity scene has become such a strong symbol of joy and hope for millions of people all over the world. In Verona, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
We hope you enjoyed our program today. I'm Montse Alvarado. Next week, a travel edition of EWTN News in Depth as we take you to some special monasteries, abbeys, and shrines around the world where our Catholic life is celebrated with joy. You won't want to miss it. We'll see you then.